Creation and
May I have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Norton,
Here.
Commissioner Benson,
Here.
Commissioner Newman,
Here.
Commissioner Dale,
Here.
and President Coleman.
Here. Would you like to join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. Do we have any report on closed session? All
No reportable action.
right, then we'll move on to public comment. This portion of the agenda allows the public to speak to the board on various issues not itemized on this agenda. A member of the public may also request that a matter appearing on the consent calendar, which is the next item, be pulled and discussed separately. Pursuant to the Brown Act, the board may not take any action on any item that does not appear on the agenda. Each speaker is limited to speak for a period of 3 minutes regarding each item on the agenda when it comes up. Each speaker is limited to speak for a period of 3 minutes during the public comment portion of the agenda regarding items of special interest to the public not appearing on the agenda that are within the subject matter of the Board of Commissioners. And if you're online, you can use the raise hand feature. And if you're on a phone, you can press star 9 to raise your hand. Do we have any members of the public wishing to make public comment tonight? Come on up.
Hello, my name is Sebastian Elright, Aqua Rodeo Farms, Humboldt Bay Oyster Tours, and Humboldt Bay Provisions. And I was just going to make some comments about water quality and anti-degradation policy and the Tier 3 rating as it re relates to anti-degradation policy. There's a strong argument that can be made considering Humboldt Bay as a Tier 3 water body under the anti-degradation policy, as it aligns closely with the criteria for outstanding national resource waters due to its ecological and commercial significance. Under the federal and state anti-degradation policy, Tier 3 status is reserved for waters where water quality must be maintained and protected without any degradation. The policy explicitly defines ONRWs as including national or state parks, wildlife refuges, or areas of exceptional recreational and ecological significance. Here is how Humboldt Bay's characteristics fulfill these Tier 3 criteria. Presence of a national wildlife refuge. Humboldt Bay directly meets the explicit text of the Tier 3 definition because it hosts the Humboldt Bay National Wildlife Refuge, which owns and protects extensive tidelands, salt marshes, and mud flats within the bay. Point number two, Native American tribal gathering and cultural significance. The policy's inclusion of areas of exceptional recreation or ecological significance applies heavily to the bay's importance to Native American tribes. The state's Basin Plan officially designates Native American culture and shellfish harvesting as existing beneficial uses of Humboldt Bay. The bay is the ancestral territory of the Wet tribe and other coastal tribes who have stewarded and depended on the bay's marine resources, including shellfish, salmon, and kelp. The subsistence com for subsistence, commerce, and spiritual ceremonies since time immemorial. The deep integration of these aquatic resources into the tribal lifeways and food sovereignty establishes an exceptional ecological and cultural baseline that requires pristine water quality. Point number three, interstate commerce of shellfish seed stock. While the anti-degradation policy does not explicitly list interstate commerce as a trigger for the Tier 3 sheer scale of Humboldt Bay's shellfish nursery operations, highlights the bay's exceptional ecological significance. The key point here is that 470 million shellfish seed were sold in 2024, and when was the last time you paid less than a dollar for an oyster? Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public wishing to make public comment tonight? Do you have anybody online? All right, seeing none in the room and none online, I'll close co public comment and move on to the consent calendar.
I move to approve consent.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Consent calendar items are approved without discussion. So I'll call a vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed or abstaining? Hearing none, consent calendar passes. Communication reports and correspondence received.
No correspondence received this month.
Okay. I will point out, and I don't know if it's the appropriate time. I think Commissioner Benson and myself both received email correspondence. I don't know if it made it to you or was meant to go into the record. So should that something like that go into the record? Is regarding just urging us to be cautious about approving any heavy lift marine terminal project.
We have to make copies available to the public, so in the future.
Yeah, I think it just came in today. Did you get that?
I didn't even see it.
Oh, okay. I saw that both of us were on the email from a member of the Samoa community.
Okay.
But I can forward that and it can go into the record for a different time.
I have quite a number of unread emails myself this evening. So,
Yeah.
although
I just,
I am in today's calendar, but.
yeah, I wasn't sure if that was meant to go into the record or not today. Okay. We have an executive director's report.
We do. And I'll follow up on correspondence. I have a sneaking suspicion. I just want to let you all know we're still working on our workplace culture and vision. We're getting positive feedback from team members that are participating. We're definitely seeing positive results in the way the office operates and the communication. So really, again, I've brought this up a couple of times, but appreciate the support that we've received in this important work. Went to an EOPA renewables presentation. I was only there for the networking session. I know others were there for other parts. I'll let them report, but really glad that EOPA extended or elected officials rather to Protect America continues to bring a lot of positive light to some of the strong work that's being done. So appreciate their continued presence here and supporting, helping us to advance our goals. Recently had Terra Phase, which is our EPA Brownfields contractor in town for some site visits, as well as quite a bit of research that was done. Incidentally, Humboldt State University has the entire set of building plans and development plans for the former Georgia Pacific LP mill site. So that was great data to be used in our EPA Brownfields assessment. So very positive step forward there in completing that. California Sea Grant had an aquaculture site visit and dinner. I was able to participate last Wednesday evening on a management tour and discussion, as well as quite a bit of networking that was done at a dinner hosted by Hog Island Oyster. So appreciate Sea Grant for hosting that, as well as Hog. Many of our growers were there and quite a few interested parties. County Humboldt Aviation had a Breeze Air inaugural flight yesterday. Mindy and I were able to attend. We were invited by the Tourism Bureau for Humboldt County or the County of Humboldt. It was a very well attended event. It was pretty fun. We watched one of our supervisors in our county administrative office spray champagne all over officer all over the aircraft, as well as perhaps themselves. There was a diesel spill reported on March 8th, this past Sunday, here at Woodley Island. The U.S. Coast Guard Marine Safety Detachment, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, OSPR, as well as different district staff responded. It was cleaned up by our staff Sunday and into Monday, and we had a very quick and responsible boat owner as well, who immediately had a neighboring vessel owner aboard his vessel, and then drove down here himself to participate in repairs. So successful overall. It was a bilge pump that was set in some pretty dirty oil and fuel into the water, but we were able to catch it very quickly due to training and watchful eyes. We also had a local citizen who lives close to the marina report it, so we're grateful for quick reporting. It was noticed in early morning hours. We have a cargo vessel inbound for arrival at Green Diamond. It should be in on the 6th. Let's see, is it the 16th? Actually, I think it's a little ahead of schedule now. It's either the 14th or the 16th, and I think we're now up to the 14th at 0400, but we're in a window to bring it in with weather and whatnot. It's here for a load of chips outbound for Japan. So that is becoming a real recurring event. We're very, very happy to see those ships in here. Finally, the Life Vest Borrowing Station is now open for business here on Whidley Island. We're scheduling a ribbon cutting in April. And remember, this is an Eagle Scout project for Timothy Grossman. Timothy is comes from a family. His grandfather is one of our tug operators and fishermen out of Humboldt Bay. So really excited for that and happy to see that Timothy's found success in his project. Just a little, they actually let us out pretty much on the runway yesterday. Thought it was fun to take a little shot of the plane landing. Oops, can't zoom in, but there's the champagne celebration. This is an example of what's in the Life Vest Borrowing Station. So these are available for people that are visiting Whidley Island or if people are launching kayaks here or recreating vessels. If they don't have the appropriate safety gear, they can borrow life vests here at the borrowing station. It'll be open each day.
Good.
And we'll pass it on to Rob.
Good evening. I don't have anything to report that you're not going to hear shortly.
All right.
Engineers report.
Thanks. Yeah, that's coming up because we don't have a district council here. So, district treasurer report. Don't have the treasurer here. So, we are at the engineers report.
I've been working on a few things. So first of all, we've been offering logistical support for the sediment sampling in Humboldt Bay, helping out Moffett Nickel. We've also are working on putting together the bid package for the stormwater treatment system for Fields Landing Boatyard. So hopefully we can get that out next month. Yeah, those are the primary things we've been working on this past month.
And do we have a district planner report?
We do. Just a brief one. But working on processing some Harbor District permits, the Coast Seafoods 10-year permit extension and renewal, continuing to process that. There was an admin permit for the Humboldt Bay Eelgrass Joint Mitigation Program sampling and analysis plan. And the Humboldt Bay Oyster Company Shellfish Farm initial study MND comment period closed, and we did receive one comment from CDFW just earlier this week. So we are reviewing that, and we'll be working with the applicant and their representative to respond to that before it comes to the board, back to the board for consideration of the permit. And then other permitting that we're working on, subtitle Mariculture Pre-Permitting CDP was a request for the 10-year renewal was submitted to the Coastal Commission. So we will be continuing to work with Coastal Commission to get that processed. The Redwood Marine Terminal 2 Master Bay Water Intake, we are going to be requesting a CDP extension for that one. And the county CDP conditional use permit for interim uses at RMT2 is scheduled for Planning Commission next week. And that's just an extension of the district's existing permit for interim uses out there. And then continuing to compile information for the regional Spartina CDP. And that is my report.
Thank you. Moving on to commissioner reports. Do any commissioners have anything they'd like to report?
I don't have anything.
Yeah, I have just a couple of things, although I have a question for Vanessa. Is it worthwhile for any of us to show at the county planning commission meeting around the CDE and conditional use permit?
What
Is there
I
value to that?
believe that Chris or myself will be attending. So I will leave that up to Chris or the commissioners. It's scheduled to be on consent. They haven't released the agenda, so it should be on consent as far as we know at this point.
We're awaiting the agenda. We'll reach out if we need a team.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Good. You know. Yeah. Next week is spring break for me at Cal Poly. Love the academic calendar and get a break every once in a while. So I'm going to take great use of it to do stuff for the Harbor District. So I'll be meeting with the Humboldt Bay Eureka 2x2 meeting on Monday, with Core Hub on Tuesday from 4 to 5. They're also professional Core Hub. I suggested that we, it's St. Patty's Day and we meet at Redwood Curtain. They said, nah, So, and then on Wednesday is the Humboldt Left Marine Terminal. I believe Rob's still the community advisory committee, five to seven on Wednesday.
That's right.
So my days will be filled with Humboldt Bay stuff during spring break. Happy
Maybe Thursday night at 6.
possibly. All right, that's all I'm going to put here.
Thank you. Very good, Aaron.
I was fortunate enough to be invited to the Sea Grant's shellfish seminar. Really, the tour and dinner. I learned a lot. They're very, very highly intelligent and respectful human beings. And I enjoyed every second I spent with them. And I learned a ton from them.
How was the captain?
Captain was exceptional as well. Didn't run aground, didn't run into any bridges. Nobody fell overboard. I thought the Mackinac tour was exceptional. Thank you, Captain. George.
Thank you.
Can I just advance the slide, please?
I actually got to go as the
Yeah.
captain of the Mackinac for that tour and enjoyed all the interactions, and I agree with everything Greg said about the Sea Grant aquaculture tour. I really want to dig more into that. We've had a really frustrating commercial crab season on the North Coast. I mean, pretty much everyone, including myself, was bringing their pots in. I caught less than half of what I normally catch in terms of Dungeness crab. And normally, this time of year, you start looking at the salmon season structures that may be approaching. And we've been closed for the last 3 years, the entire state. And about 3 weeks ago, the numbers that you see on this slide, first slide ever for me in a commissioning report, which is a big deal. Probably never seen another one. So,
Explain this.
the bottom numbers on the graph is the jack escapement for the Sacramento River, and the side is in. Those are actually 500,000, a million and a half fish. That's the only real thing they have to indicate what's going to come back for the 2026 season for all fishery, all the fisheries in California are basically keyed to Sacramento stocks. If you look at that black dot, we had one of the highest jack counts in the history of counting, clear back to 1983, I believe, this on this when they started doing these counts and these jack assessments to determine the following year's run size and the subsequent seasons that will get arranged. If you look at those numbers on the actual graph, those are years. And that line of is kind of a line they built to make it make more sense when they had some lower numbers in recent years. So they forecasted basically half of what their diminished line of regression would have forecasted. It looks like 600,000 fish, could be as many as a million and a half fish, but they said that there's 392,000 fish available in the ocean for all fisheries in Oregon and California, and of course in the river. So pretty much, they're saying the season's going to be closed for the fourth year in a row.
Even though the trends are positive in terms
The
of
trends are
jack
amazing.
escapement, and
The trends, I
so it's
mean,
a political rather than a biological decision, you would think.
during the down years, they put impediments in the. I was California Salmon Advisor for the PFMC for a couple of years, so I know all this works. They put in rules that they have to follow. When abundance comes back, that makes it impossible to give us a season. And that's what we're up against now. There's a lot more to the story. It's a quagmire of statistics, but basically that black dot says that we're not going to get any kind of a reasonable salmon season when there might well be one of the biggest returns in the last 30 years. And what could happen is you get these major fish kills in the river like we had in 2004 because the fish don't get harvested. It's really a gut punch to the fleet. And in reality, the commercial salmon fleet in California is only about 400 boats in. And about 200 of those boats are really active. And that's the commercial perspective. The recreational perspective is hundreds of thousands of people up and down the state that are not going to get much opportunity because of this. So Anyway, very frustrating. And if you're interested, there's a ton more information out there.
Those are projected escapements based on the jack escapement, right?
6 to 1, and it's normally 20 to 1.
So what's the actuals? So when you look at 2012, I'm assuming it's 2012.
That's what came back in 2012 on a 85,000 jack.
So that's an actual escapement.
That's what pulled that line down. If you look at the other, like 2013, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 800,000 fish for a lower jack count. 12 was it was also an El Nino situation, so they had a survival issue. And that there's a lot to this. I mean, there's so many variables that affect salmon returns, and especially in the Central Valley of California, it's, let's face it, it's a nuclear wasteland of a fish habitat. It's all dammed and that turned into agricultural lands, and most of the fish come from hatcheries, and that's the reality of it. So anyway, it's a real gut punch to the fishing fleet. That's my report.
Thank you for that report and the impressive slide.
Compliments of the Fish and Wildlife.
I don't have much myself to report other than sadly, for the second year in the row, I won't be jumping in the bay for the perilous plunge, which is I'll be out of town on the 21st. But this is something that happens every year. People dress up in silly costumes and jump in the bay to support the Redwood Discovery Museum. So I encourage you to either go watch. It's a fun event to watch on Saturday the 21st, or go to the Redwood Discovery Museum website and donate to your favorite people who you want to see jump in the bay. I'm out of town going to help support my mom who's having some health issues. So I'm not going to be able to jump in the water. Moving on to unfinished business. Let's receive a status update regarding the Humble Bay Offshore Wind Heavy Lift Marine Terminal project.
All right. Got some good news, but let's start with an introduction. Shelley is with Moffitt Nickel, and yeah, Shelley's in town from San Diego office and leading a team of people that are currently conducting sediment sampling in the bay at the berth wet storage areas. So if you have any questions for Shelley, she's here. She is currently the project manager from Moffitt Nickel for the project. All right, funding update. I've done this before. We lost the federal grants. That first grant, a good chunk of it was meant as a match to the large federal grant. And then half of our smaller federal grant was spent and half was not spent. So we've been working with the Energy Commission to reconfigure to replace that lost money with money from the CEC, which is coincidentally just about the same amount that was matched before. That finally went through last week, and so now we are back up and running. And so now we can start talking about schedule. So this is a slide exactly as presented to you this past June. So we were in the middle of 2025. Fundraising and grants will go into the future. Community engagement, advisory committees, public meetings, board meetings, tribal engagement will all go into the future. Special studies were anticipated to end around 2025 at the time, with possible extensions through 26. CEQA and permits were going to be finished in early 26. And the CEQA DIR hearing was a critical time or a critical milestone. Then the design process, construction of mitigation, construction of the project phase 1 and 2. Then a couple of months later, in August, those federal grants were rescinded. And so I presented this again and extended the timelines a little bit, but nothing really fundamentally changed. Now we are here and we're back on track. And so the schedule is going to have to shift a little bit, but not by a lot. So this is the new final schedule as of right now. And we really can't extend it any further because of our grants. They have, we've done some extensions. We can't extend our primary grant any further. So we have to be finished per this timeline here. So construction's not really relevant to the grant, and it's speculative, so I'm going to take that off. And regardless of what happens, we're going to continue to do fundraising and engagement, so I'll take those off because those continue into the future indefinitely. So right now, the critical milestone everyone should be keeping their eyes on is the DIR being released for public comment in early 27 and the submittal of all of our permit applications at that time. Now, the CEQA permit timeline could extend beyond that. So that's the DEIR. It depends on a lot of factors on how long that takes, but it's a minimum of 45 days from the DEIR to the FEIR, so a month and a half, but it could extend past that. And there's no way to predict exactly how long permit approvals will take. It could go deep into the future, but we think that should be less than 12 months. And then design will continue right up to the moment of construction. Things will change a little bit here and there. And then special studies might come online, but those are non-CEQA related. If they occur after CEQA, that's just supplemental to design if necessary. So if we zoom in on these here and really dig into the details, the project description has to be done in June. That is a critical milestone. The special studies, analyzing what the impacts of that project description are, or I'm collecting field studies, I'm sorry, and gathering more information, needs to be done by August. That's a critical milestone. And then the NOP we're going to re-release. The DEIR will be released for public comment. And then a hearing before you. We're targeting March of 27. So that is the deadline. So a year from now. And then again, the FEIR and approvals will extend beyond that, but we can't exactly know. But best guess, mid 27, late 27 for the permits. So turn those all just into bullet list. Those are the critical dates to know. We can't really flex those at this point. And then things in yellow are kind of uncertain at the moment. So those are our best guess for those. Somewhere in there, we will likely have to select an operator and go through that process. So what's in that box there isn't going to change. And so here's what it all looks like back together again. And Prop 4 is a part of this picture as well. So if you recall, there's a climate bond passed by the Voter Initiative. And a good chunk, well, it's actually a tiny portion of it, but it's still a lot of money, is dedicated to offshore wind port terminals. So that is really the thing to keep your eye on is the DIR 1 year from today. All right. And then these are the ongoing considerations, the high-flying topics that we hear about the most, and we're continuing to work on all of these and more. All right, and tonight we have some guests. Pete's talking about community benefits, and if you recall, in January I did a presentation pretty extensive on community benefits. I'm not going to do it again, but just to remind you, we defined what community benefits are. We talked about the district's limited role in offshore wind and community benefits. There will be community benefit agreements for the projects in the ocean. Those are not related to us. We have no control over those. We do have control and influence and the direct role of anything community benefit related for the heavy lift marine terminal. We talked about different types of benefits. Tonight you're going to hear mostly, I think, about community benefit agreements. But if you recall, there are natural benefits of a project that are just inherent to the project. We're building in additional benefits, and then there are community benefit programs and agreements on the outside of that. The closer benefit is to the core of the project, the better it is for everyone because it's just built into the project or naturally occurring. And recall that natural benefits are intrinsic, whereas community benefit agreements are transactional. And I encourage you to revisit that staff report. You can go to that link and watch the presentation. Community benefits, really important topic, and there was probably 20 minutes of content provided there. All right, so tonight we have these guest speakers from OSU and the Schatz Energy Research Center. And I believe I am passing it to Lauren or Julia.
Julia.
Julia online to do an introduction.
Yeah, and Lauren should be sharing her screen slides.
Correct.
Who's first, Julia?
Lauren will be sharing the screen for all visitors. But Julian start.
So Julie's talking and Laura is sharing.
Hi, this is Julia. Can everyone hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Okay, great. I don't know if you want me to be able to undo my, like, open my video, but as long as you hear me, great. My name's Julia. I'm a postdoctoral scholar at Oregon State University. We have others from our research team joining us. So from our Cal Poly Humboldt and Schatz Energy Center team, Arnie Jacobson, one of our lead faculty, is there in person, and Tanner Etherton's on our team, and he'll also be presenting some of this work. Lauren Hart online is one of our grad students and will present a little bit as well. And then Greg Stelmach is another member of our OSU team, and we can all field questions if there are some. This project's a collaboration between Oregon State University, Cal Poly Humboldt, University of Washington, UMaine, and University of Delaware. And we're focused on coastal community perceptions around offshore energy development, and especially potential benefits and impacts from offshore wind energy, and especially focused on community benefit mechanisms, especially those formal agreements between developers and community actors, like community benefit agreements, CBAs. Lauren, can we pass on to the next slide, please? Thanks. So for time's sake, I won't spend too much time on background, but I can share about it if there's questions about what the background of the work is. But this is a multi-phase project. The first was aimed to get a better understanding of what offshore wind related CBAs have looked like so far, and potentially some identify some lessons learned from those processes. So especially focused on East Coast cases. We did that through a review of offshore wind related CBAs, all of them through 2024. It included document review and conducting interviews with developers, community organizations, and municipal officials that were involved in those CBAs. We're not going to focus as much on the results of that phase with this specific presentation due to time, but we can definitely answer questions about it. And we do have some slides that we could potentially share out if those results are of interest to the folks here today. The next two phases emphasized understanding community perceptions around offshore wind and CBAs, and specifically focused on six communities that would face floating offshore wind technology in the case of future development. And that included the Humboldt Bay area, and specifically Eureka and the Samoa Peninsula. The other case sites included Westport Grayland, Washington, Coos Bay, Oregon, Brookings, Oregon, and then Searsport and Yarmouth in Maine. In these phases, we interviewed community leaders in each site, and we conducted drop-off pickup surveys of the broader community populations over this past summer. Originally, we'd plan on doing follow-up interviews after a year or two, but our federal funding that would have supported that stage was cut in October. So right now we're working on finishing up our analysis of the phases 2 and 3, and we have some good preliminary results. And we intend to have public facing research products to share out those findings, and hopefully to also offer policy recommendations and potentially help communities and development organizations prepare for potentially engaging in offshore energy related CBAs in the future in those communities. And so for the rest of the presentation, I'm going to pass it over to Tanner and Lauren to get into the results of those two phases that are specific to the Humboldt Bay area, and that were led by our Cal Poly Humboldt team.
So we're going to start off with Lauren for this piece.
Can everyone hear me all right?
Yes.
All right. So like Julia said, my name is Lauren Hart, and I'm a graduate research assistant with the Schatz Energy Research Center. And in this part of the presentation, I'm going to be discussing some early findings from the interviews conducted for this project around the Humboldt Bay area. All right. So we conducted 30 interviews with community leaders between December of 2024 and January of 2026. And so these interviews were designed to gain an in-depth understanding of how people are thinking about both offshore wind development and community benefit agreements, and then the experiences and values that shape their perspectives. And so the key word in here is in-depth. That's something that you can get from the interviews that you can't from the survey work that we also did. And I just want to note here too that when we're discussing like offshore wind development in these interviews, we make sure that the interview participants know that that involves the offshore wind farms themselves, but also transmission, manufacturing, and ports. So I'll briefly walk through five key themes from the interviews and with some takeaways from our interview work so far. And then we'll go to Tanner to discuss the surveys that we've done. So this first theme is wariness of industry. So there's a long and complicated relationship with large extractive industries here, and the community's historic memory of the environmental damage and economic instability left behind from the logging and cannabis industries is really shaping how they've been evaluating offshore wind from the start of the projects. People's hesitation in this context isn't necessarily opposition, but they're saying that they want to know more about what makes this industry different from the other ones. The second theme, trade-off tensions. So many participants expressed openness to offshore wind, but it was cautious. It's only if the trade-offs are clear and the benefits are meaningful and local. And so what we found here is that there's generally a shared desire to address climate change, but climate benefits from these projects would be shared globally. And community members have expressed that they need to see benefits that address local needs like infrastructure, resilience, and access to services to make the local impacts to them feel more worthwhile. The next theme here, uncomfortable consensus. So community members have described a lot about the challenges of community benefit conversations, including how to share or how to build a shared vision for the community across groups with competing priorities. And so one participant described a realistic goal of these conversations as an uncomfortable consensus. And collaboration has brought the community together in many ways, but it takes a lot of time, trust, and emotional labor, which brings me to the next theme, engagement burdens. So commonly, our participants talked about the costs of engagement. They talked about how they're volunteering significant time, often without compensation, and while managing other urgent community needs. And so some participants described feeling really burnt out, and especially now given some political uncertainty around offshore wind's future. And then the last theme that I'm going to talk about today is knowledge gaps. So all of this is happening for the community under uncertain circumstances. So floating offshore wind technology is still evolving, and specific design details, operational plans, and impact data aren't always available in the ways that community want them to be. And so that makes it difficult for people to form opinions, participate in planning, and weigh trade-offs. I also wanted to highlight here just a few comments that were directly related to port development. These obviously aren't all of them, but these are kind of reflect some of the most common topics that come up. So some of those are impacts on indigenous sites and MMIP, impacts on commercial fishing, especially cumulative impacts from both terminal operations and turbines offshore. Public safety and social impacts. People are talking about they want to proactively address existing vulnerabilities in the nearby communities. And then people we talked to were also concerned about how and when community input can meaningfully influence decisions. And so what we're seeing from these interviews aren't simple like pro or anti offshore wind or offshore wind narratives. And what we're seeing instead is that community perceptions of offshore wind are deeply shaped by the history of logging operations and around the bay and mistrust from that. Community members are weighing potential trade-offs and looking for clear, local, and enforceable benefits to balance the potential burdens. There's willingness to find compromise between groups, but it requires thoughtful facilitation. Engagement has real costs, and capacity support for community members really matters. And then technical transparency is critical. The more specific and concrete information available about offshore wind-related projects, the easier it will be for the community to evaluate trade-offs. And that's it for this section. Thank you. I'm going to pass it over to Tanner now to discuss our survey work.
Thanks, Lauren. Thank you, commissioners and Harbor District staff for having us. My name is Tanner Etherton. I'm an economic analyst with the Shotts Energy Research Center, as well as an offshore wind extension specialist with California Sea Grant. And I was part of the research team here in Humboldt that conducted surveys to help us better understand our community's perceptions around the potential benefits and impacts of offshore wind development on the North Coast. Lauren, next slide. There's a lot to cover here today. So I'm going to move kind of quickly, but we will make these presentations available to your board. And this presentation in particular does include an appendix with additional findings and results. So first, looking at our survey area, the research team used stratified random sampling to select 9 census block groups in and around the town of or city of Eureka, balancing between different income levels and proximity to the bay. We also purposely chose to survey the Samoa Peninsula, given its close proximity to the heavy lift marine terminal. Next slide. Here we see the approximate location of those responses, or basically where we surveyed. So notably on the peninsula, in the town of Manila, the town of Samoa, and the town of Fairhaven, and then throughout the block groups in the city of Eureka. Next slide. Our response rates were pretty high throughout. And so you can see the response rates by block group. Highest on the Samoa Peninsula at 71%, and then the lowest response rate out along the Eureka waterfront. Next slide. The survey itself was designed to take about 15 to 20 minutes. We used stratified random sampling to select roughly 700 addresses in each community that was surveyed. And we used drop-off pickup methodology. So basically, we were going door to door, dropping off the survey, and then coming back day after day to collect those to try to encourage response rates. Next slide. There was context in the survey regarding the offshore wind development projects off the coast of these communities, as well as additional context regarding adjacent infrastructure that might be necessitated. Next slide. Here you can see the demographic profiles across those 3 West Coast communities. So you have Eureka, Coos Bay, Oregon, and Westport, Washington. Notably, next slide. And you can see in Eureka, there was a lower proportion of respondents who owned a home, a higher proportion that could see the ocean from their residence, and a higher proportion that were Democrat versus Republican compared to Coos Bay and Westport. Next slide. Participants were asked whether or not they supported or opposed leasing ocean space off the coast of their state. For those who were unsure, they could then indicate whether they were leaning in support or opposition or neither, or perhaps they didn't have enough information to form an opinion. Next slide. You can see the results to that question and quickly notice that Eureka had about twice the level of support as compared to Coos Bay or Westport, and about the half the level of opposition. And then the unsure group, you see sort of a similar proportion across all sample areas. Next slide. But when you break that down, you can also notice that in Eureka, a greater proportion were leaning towards support in that unsure group. Next slide. At the Shotts Center, we were specifically looking at trying for this preliminary analysis at characterizing these 3 subgroups. So those who were supportive or unsure or in opposition. And for that unsure group, we did not break it down further. Next slide. Here you can see the different subgroups, the demographic profiles for the different subgroups. Next slide. We noted some significant differences across these groups. Next slide. I won't go into detail on these currently, but I encourage you to check back over the slides. Next slide. Additionally, we looked at perceptions of impacts from offshore wind across a variety of topics related to offshore wind based on discussions that we've had. And participants were able to indicate or gauge that level of impact from very negatively to very positively. And this is for the sample as a whole. Next slide. So for part of our analysis, we looked at the difference in these perceived impacts across the support and opposition group. We found that those who were in a opposition to offshore wind tend to have stronger negative sentiments, so perceived very negative impacts, while supporters were more likely to receive slightly more positive impacts and less risk across all categories. Both groups perceived higher risk to tribal, cultural, and marine life-related impacts, and higher benefits to economic development and electricity outcome system outcomes with little perceived risk. Next slide. We also wanted to understand how these perceptions might change, and there were a couple of questions in the survey that got at this. This one in particular is looking at where that energy goes from these offshore wind projects. And the chart you're looking at is respondents who are unsure about offshore wind and whether or not they were more opposed or more supportive, depending on where the electricity goes. Next slide. What we found is that opposition increases as that energy is described as going to other states. Support increases as it's described as staying in California. However, if it's described as going specifically to city centers in California, that effect dampens and you get sort of a more mixed result. Next slide. Additionally, participants are asked whether or not adding a local benefit agreement would change their stance on offshore wind. Next slide. And what we found across the support and unsure group is that they are more supportive if there is a local benefit agreement included for these types of projects. However, the opposition group was more resistant, with most indicating no change or even increased opposition rather than increased support. Next slide. However, when asked whether or not they agreed with the statement, should it be mandatory that large infrastructure projects like offshore wind include a local benefit agreement? Next slide. All three groups tended to agree with this sentiment. Next slide. So here's some of our preliminary findings from this preliminary analysis. So in the Eureka Samoa survey, we had nearly twice as many respondents support offshore wind as opposed. A substantial number were unsure. Overall, respondents expressed mixed views with perceived benefits strongest for climate change and economic development, and perceived risks more prominent for cultural, tribal, community, and marine-related impacts. Supported opposition and uncertainty reflect distinct patterns. So supporters tend to have a higher trust in institutions and perceive less risk and more benefit. And then oppositions have a lower trust in institutions and perceive higher risks. And then the unsure group tend to report lower levels of knowledge and higher uncertainty. Perceptions also appear to be responsive to the project design and benefit framing, with local energy use and community benefit agreements associated with increased support, and particularly for those who were found to be unsure about offshore wind. Next slide. Excuse me. So next steps, more community presentations like this from the research team, sharing out the findings and pushing out publicly accessible reports. They plan to develop community toolkits and recommendations for communities that are going through this community benefit agreement process, make recommendations to state and regional actors that are seeking input, and then, of course, coordinate with other offshore wind energy efforts so that we might build on these findings. And with that, we'll jump into a Q&A. Thank you all.
Thank you. Very informative presentations. Any questions or comments from the board?
I guess I have one. You said your funding got cut off and part of the project that wasn't finished. And so we're talking about continuing further in the research and engagement with the community. But so where are we going to get the funding for that?
Ernie, you want to speak to that?
Sure. We are essentially trying to get some of this information out on the shoestring.
Let me speak into the microphone.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's on. Yeah.
Because we don't have the federal funding that was originally allocated to that, we're essentially trying to report the findings to the degree we can and complete analysis essentially on a shoestring. Like we have small amounts of money that we're able to allocate to this, and we're doing that because we feel a responsibility that, you know, we did all of this work. We took people's time in our community. We feel like it's important to report it out, but we're not able to do that analysis or reporting to the degree that we would if the funding had stayed in place.
Is there a foundation or some charitable funding that's out there besides, it seems like all the federal grants got, you know, their policies have definitely changed and
Now the landscape is more looking towards a state or foundations or other types of sort resources. And I'm just wondering what sort of where you're at with trying to pursue that. I think myself, I'm pretty I'm a big proponent of this project, but I'd like to see as much more resources going into areas where we just don't have the funding.
Right. And so
on a federal level.
Right. Each of the universities is in a slightly different position in terms of what resources they had available. And so Julia or Greg may be able to speak a little bit more to what Oregon State's resources are. I can speak to our team at the Schatz Energy Research Center. We do have some small amounts of funding, primarily from foundation resources, that we were able to allocate towards completing and doing the reporting out that we've done so far, following the loss of the federal funding.
Great, thank you.
Anything else you can?
Yeah,
on board.
Go ahead, Craig.
Yeah. Thank you so much for these presentations. Thanks to all the speakers. This is incredibly valuable to us, as public decision makers,
right,
to get not only our feedback on what local folks think. And I really appreciate that you focused on the peninsula and Eureka. That's my division. So that's my constituency specifically, who are really at ground zero for this and are most impacted by this. So that was really valuable. I'd like to get a hold of more of that information and get a little bit more granular with it. But I really appreciated seeing sort of the Pacific Coast response compared to the local response. That was really valuable. And both Julia and Lauren, just really great to see, just a wonderful summary of, wariness of industry and trade-off tensions and uncomfortable consensus and so on. And I just love the way that they framed that in fairly simple takeaway terms for us who are we're boiled down in 20, 30 documents all the time that get into super granular details about technical aspects. So it's really great to get a public survey, public opinion take on this, because I'll just speak for myself. I will remain undecided about whether I'm supporting offshore wind or opposing it until the time that we really have to certify the CEQA analysis. I may end up being the only, a person on this commission who opposes it because my constituency opposes it. But I'm also, because I talk to my constituency a lot, and what's interesting is that locally twice as many support than oppose. This is, this is important information for me to have, because I can talk to a lot of people, but I may not talk to everybody. And so some of your groups are really important for me to help me as a decision maker, just being personal about it. But I know, the others as well. So, but here's I'll end up with a question. My understanding is that this was really getting opinion about offshore wind, so what's happening out of our control. Then we also have the heavy lift marine terminal, which may, which would be in support of offshore wind, and potentially in some future that we don't know about, maybe some different industry other than that as well. So I'm curious, was it clear to you that the people answering the question were really differentiating between the heavy lift marine terminal project and the offshore wind project? Or were they just sort of putting it all together in their minds? I'm just curious. I don't know if you have a science-based take on that, but even just a personal take on that.
Yeah, I mean, so we need to make sure that the surveys were consistent throughout the different communities, and not every community has a port development happening.
Yeah.
But we did try to provide that context, not just of the offshore wind project, but that there is this adjacent infrastructure that might be necessary. Whether or not that individual was thinking about it in that way is hard to say, but for those who are aware, I can imagine that it's not somewhat a part of their thought process. We do try to gauge, there is questions in there to try to gauge knowledge level about offshore wind, but again, it is about offshore wind development and not necessarily port development.
And so that was made really clear to all of the respondents that this is about what's happening 20 and 30 miles offshore, not what's happening
in
Numble Bay.
Not necessarily. Greg, do you want to speak to the survey design at all, if you're there? Our team from OSU designed the survey, and I think that this was a big part of the discussion, though,
yeah,
because obviously it is hard to separate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. They're legs of the same stool.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not, it wasn't meant to fully separate them. I mean, if they choose to look at it through that lens, yeah, of including them together, then that's how they see it. And I don't think, you know, we provided that context so that they understand that there's a whole picture around offshore wind. It's not simply projects out offshore.
Hey, Tanner, I'm on here now. Sorry, I was just taking a second to get me unmuted. I can speak a little bit about it. We had, you know, at the beginning of the survey, kind of a descriptor about, you know, offshore wind is not just one thing. You know, there's a lot of different elements to the projects, including marine terminal development. And a lot of the questions we asked about CBAs were kind of framed in that context of, you know, the associated infrastructure with it. So they were kind of tied together there. The question about the stance on it was more explicitly about, you know, leasing ocean space for the development of offshore wind energy off the coast of California. And then the CBA stuff was kind of tied more into all aspects of it.
And I can speak quickly to the interviews, because I think they do provide that depth. Interview participants were able to say when they were speaking about ports specifically versus when they were speaking about the turbines that are going to be offshore versus transmission. So there's a little bit more of that nuance that comes from the interviews. And in our coding process for that, we're kind of picking out when we're talking about port specific considerations.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, my comment in kind of looking forward into, you know, any further surveys is you can see from our perspective where we really only have the legal ability to talk about what's going to happen in Humboldt Bay. That sort of, we have these parameters in our decision making that isn't about what's happening 20 or 30 miles out, but we're not blind to the synergy between them, that it's helpful for us to know as specifically as possible, is this about this part, this leg of the stool, this leg of the stool, or this leg of the stool? Same thing with transmission. We wouldn't be just making decisions for PG&E about how transmission might come from the ocean to make landfall. So it's so there's a lot of pieces, and for us decide being really clear on what we are deciding.
I agree with Commissioner Benson, and I'd like to kind of build on what I think you're saying. As a member of the fishing community and a member of this board and a bunch of other stuff, I really don't know what the project looks like. No one does. It's building as it goes to a certain extent. I really feel for aquaculture people. They're just like me as a fisherman. We don't know what the impacts are going to be. We don't know what the project's going to look like. We don't even have a final design on the marine terminal we're building. So to ask me a question in a survey, whether or not I'm for or against, or it's disingenuous in a lot of ways to me to think that perfect strangers to this are asked their opinion without any background, when people that are actually in the know don't have the background they'd like to have. So that's my big criticism. I think I'm kind of building on what Commissioner Benson's saying. It's the cart's way over here and the horse hasn't been found yet, and we're asked, do we support this? So I really deal with a lot of people's opinions with not enough information.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to respond to that. A couple questions myself, but I'll...
Yeah, I mean, sure, we could respond to that. I think that's of course a fair take. I think we don't know what these projects are going to look like, and we don't know how much the people who were responding to the survey truly knew or why they felt the way they did. But we surveyed a large enough sample to sort of get an idea of where our community stands on certain things. And they weren't just about where the impacts or benefits are. We asked questions about where you'd like to see local benefit funding used and towards what sort of infrastructure. And whether or not that information is useful to policymakers or decision makers like yourself is really up to you to decide how you might use that information. And this, again, is just the preliminary results. And there'll be a number of reports that come out of these studies, not just here at Humboldt, but from OSU and Delaware, that have found some really interesting findings that I think people of this board would be interested, despite it being a lot, the larger industry as a whole. And of course, all the unknowns. And this project was specifically for floating offshore wind, which
And I guess one of the most
we
troubling
know more
things
about.
is the biggest, the most profound thing I saw when you looked at Oregon and Washington versus California was political party lines, which really means that it's not about the project, it's about people's perceptions.
Yeah, we did, and that was one of the findings that I skipped through, but that Democrats or supporters of offshore wind or leasing offshore wind space off the coast of their state tended to be Democrat, and Republicans tend to be in opposition. Although, if you look at the sample, you'll have the same, nearly the same percentage of people who were opposed to offshore wind were Republican as they were Democrat. So someone's, if they're Democrat, it can predict their stance. But just because you're against offshore wind doesn't mean you're Republican. You could also be Democrat.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry, did you have more to add?
No.
Thank you for coming and presenting this to us. I was really interested in seeing those results, and I'm really interested in seeing any further interpretation of the results and recommendations that come of the results. I do, while I echo Aaron's concern about asking people about something that they don't know about, I think we're still, I mean, people are trying to form the best opinions that they can with what little information that they have. And unfortunately, we do live in a world full of disinformation or misinformation or skewed information that makes it challenging. One of the things, that's not surprising, but just still stands out to me whenever I see it, because it comes up a lot of times when I talk to people and in meetings, is how the perception changes with where the electricity that is being generated by these wind farms go. And that's something, that's a perspective that I really try and wrap my brain around when I talk to people. In the public, I've asked, people will often say, oh, all this electricity is just going to the cities, which makes me think, where a lot of people don't have objections to whatever products they're creating being sold to the cities, and not to pick on you, but you probably don't mind if your oysters are being bought in San Francisco or if they're being purchased here. But I guess the difference is people don't necessarily see this as a product from Humboldt County that's being sold. And so if part of the community benefit was that there was, people saw some sort of value in the sale of this commodity outside of the area that was bringing benefit to this area. And I'm not just talking about the port development, but the industry as a whole. When I talk to people on an individual basis, the perspective changes. And also from my day job at working with a community choice aggregator, the thing that I hear many people saying, like, will this make our electricity rates go down? And so if there were some benefit that was built into the entire overarching project that treated this as a commodity from Humboldt County that then benefited with some sort of profit sharing or benefit to where we were getting something like that. And while that's not something on this board we have jurisdiction over, I think we have a responsibility, or we can on this board, either as individual members of our community or as this board, advocate in every way possible that out of this greater project, if it were to happen, that those type of benefits that are going to be most meaningful and most impactful to the largest community can be built in and can happen. I think that's something that we can impact while also doing our due diligence to analyze the recommendations that come before us in a DEIR, make sure whatever project we are supporting, if we do support it, is the best project possible for the community. But I think we, as the role that we have as part of this community, I'd like to see us really advocate for full added benefits coming to that and treating this as something that we can be proud of, that we have in our community, that we can be selling to the outside. Because yeah, we don't have enough grow houses to use all this electricity that could be generated. There's not enough grow houses in Humboldt for that. So that's all I have on that, but
I would just say that rate relief was high up there in terms of how people would like to see potential community benefit agreement funding used. And then, as Lauren noted in her interviews, extraction, concern about another boom bust economy and extraction of resources. There's a lens to this as well. And then, lastly, we talked a lot about sort of the impacts and of associating this with a port development. But some of the biggest benefits that we saw, at least in our sample, was economic development and jobs, which here locally is highly associated with the port. So,
thanks.
thank you.
There's nothing else from the board at this time. I'll bring it out to the public for comment, either in the, I guess we'll start with in the room. That any
Comment only, not answer.
correct. Yeah, I mean,
So public.
yeah, if at the end there's like something that we choose to address, we can do that. But yeah, it's not a, we're not looking to have a back and forth conversation here. We're looking for public comment that'll be taken into the record for on this presentation. Anybody from in the room care to make public comment? It must have just been that good of a presentation. Everybody's questions were answered.
There's a hand up.
Yeah, so we'll move to the so I guess moving to online, and will you just handle c calling on people, or do you want me to do that, Mindy?
Jen called. She can't hear me.
Oh, okay.
Hi, everybody. Jen Colt with Humboldt Water Keeper. Thanks so much for having this presentation. I remember being interviewed for this. It was quite a while ago, though. So it's definitely interesting to think about the question whether most people or some people or anybody was thinking about the terminal. Because, as representative of Humboldt Water Keeper, I primarily think about the impacts of the terminal on Humboldt Bay. But I find that most people do not. But most people don't know that there's a huge oyster seed industry here in Humboldt Bay either. So, there's just a lot of different perceptions and people's experience and all that sort of thing. What something that strikes me is there's been some talk and remarks about misinformation and disinformation, and something that has really struck me lately is the fact that the Harbor District is the lead agency for CEQA and the project proponent leaves a lot of people wondering about the transparency and what kind of information is coming out of the Harbor District. And I hear this quite a bit from people who want more information, but that information is just not really forthcoming. And so then to hear people say, well, people are just misinformed or uninformed, it's it there's there it takes two to figure out how are we going to get people informed. And it's not just sharing information when it's all a complete report and everything's ready for the public to weigh in on. So early engagement is super important. I did have a question. I know you don't want to back and forth, but you didn't take any comments after the development director's Homeland's report. And I just wondered if Rob might be able to explain why the notice of preparation is going to be recirculated for the heavy lift terminal. I have not heard that before. Thank you.
All right, before we go into responses, do we have any more comments or questions online? I think I'll entertain that, Rob, if you want to answer that question.
Sure. So we released a notice of preparation for CEQA. It kind of announces that the project is going into a CEQA review. identifies the project description. We did that in August of 24, so it's been a while. So we've decided to voluntarily do a notice of preparation again. It has a 30-day comment period, so it just kind of is an opportunity to re-engage the public in an official CEQA capacity.
Okay, so we're not required to do it, but we're choosing to do it in order to
That's correct.
encourage more public participation, is
That's
what I'm hearing.
correct.
Not to try and feed things. I mean, it sounds like asking for more public engagement, not trying to change something.
I'd like to add too that since the first NOP, we made we adopted this idea that we would receive the we and the public would receive an update every month that we met. So we've now had 2 years of an extra layer of transparency and presentations every time, just about from consultants and others. So I think the public probably, I'm assuming, knows more. I think we're at last count 146 public meetings we've had on this.
Yeah,
186, something
yeah.
crazy amount of public meetings, on this. And so one thing that I wonder is like, how do we do it even better? And I believe we can, but I think we've gone really, really far, to be incredibly, transparent. But so I'm hoping that we, maybe from the survey takers, we're open to knowing how to do it better. Your recommendations are also something that we want to hear. That's all. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Well, if there is no further comment or discussion on this matter, I'll thank our presenters very much. That was very informative. Really appreciate it. And yeah. And I will move on to the next item. We're going to receive a status update on the preliminary review and discussion to amend and fully restate Ordinance Number 9.
So this is just a brief status update because we have two ordinances that are currently in a status to amend. We just want to make sure that everybody knows these aren't going away while we do our work. So we'll have a status update each of the coming meetings until such time as these are brought back to the board for restatement and adoption. So as for Ordinance Number 9, these are the rules and regulations for Whidley Island Marina. We've been meeting with folks in our fishing fleet. Liveaboard tenants, Commissioner Newman, myself, and staff met with one of our long-term liveaboard tenants this past Friday. We have a couple more meetings that we're trying to schedule around crab season with interested parties that would like to come forward. So we'll continue those meetings. We also are ever so close. We're waiting for two more people to confirm about the Wildlife Committee because we want our Wildlife Committee to meet, even though it's separate from Ordinance Number 9. It is part of the overall operation and what we do on Whidley Island. So we'll continue those very likely for the next through into and maybe past the next board meeting with the goal of bringing this back for adoption, perhaps as early as April, but most likely May. So just a brief status update to let you know that we are actively working on that meetings are occurring and we have a few more schedules.
Great, thank you. I guess this is an agenda item, so any discussion or comments from the board?
Nope.
And from the public, either in the room or online? All right, thank you for that update. And then we'll go to the next ordinance update. Receive a status update on the consideration of adopting Ordinance Number 21, an ordinance of the Board of Commissioners of the Humble Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District relating to the prohibition, storage, and handling of offshore produced oil on district-owned property.
So again, a status update to ensure everyone knows that we are working on this. There's been some further developments in the federal government, including perhaps more environmental work to move this forward. I don't know that we'd call it some fast tracking, but it's certainly feeling that way, as well as the potential for some mining offshore. So we're watching that very closely. We're also looking for the county's action. As you remember, we brought this to you and said the county's looking at there was a ballot initiative that passed quite successfully in the late 80s, but it wasn't actually brought into adoption in terms of zoning code. So there is some action right now at the county to see if that could happen and it could amend the local plan and become a zoning action. And so we don't want to do anything to impede that action. At the same time, staff is watching very closely, both in our California Association of Port Authorities meetings as well as other harbors and port associations, and really keeping our pulse on what's happening out there. So as further developments happen, we will update the board. But at this point in time, it is our plan to allow the county to complete their work, ultimately make their adoptions to update and amend zoning code. And I believe it's the local coastal plan, sorry, that will be amended, and then bring it back to our board for a little bit more change. We're going to add things around natural gas or a couple other recommendations in the past meeting. Again, the goal would be probably around May, but we have to wait for others for their calendars. So again, we're just making sure we're keeping this alive. I think if we remove it from the agenda, people may have think that we're not working on it or that it's been forgotten.
And you mentioned discussing this at the Port Authority meetings. Are you able to like what the general sort of perspective from other ports around the state are on this topic?
There have been outreach. This is, I don't, certainly we can't speak for other ports, right? And not every port is looking to be as affected by this as some. There are obviously ports that participate in petroleum products, and not everybody has the same view. But it is a discussion that's come up through some of the various groups. I don't know that ports as a whole will take a formal action on it as they do on certain items. But it's certainly been an item of discussion recently. I don't want to project. I think it's more about the administration and their quick and decisive actions in the process than it necessarily is the activities. But again, that's not speaking for any other port. There's just some discussion that's slowly brewing out there.
All right, and then any other discussion, comments from the board?
I look forward to having a more robust conversation, because this is for me, this is a tricky one. Because on one hand, and it's very easy to politicize, because on one hand we are looking to not support any offshore drilling and basically adding to the petroleum economy, and on the other hand we're offering to support an industry that's decarbonizing, and that's very polarized. What I just want to continue to reiterate at that this is supporting what many California communities, and especially ours, have been opposing: offshore oil drilling for many, many decades. And this is sort of a continuation of that fight, and less one that's like for or against offshore wind and a decarbonizing kind of economy. And but I also want to just reiterate to the public that this is not about disallowing petroleum products to come into the port. We have boats that run on diesel and petrol, and many docks have it. We have Renner come in here, so we're not looking to create a Humboldt Bay without petroleum products at all. There's grease and lubricants that are needed for lots of industry that happens around here. We're really just specifically looking to consider what it would look like if we disallowed specifically petroleum products from offshore drilling off of the coast here.
Well, it's also limited to district property.
That's correct.
So
Yeah.
this ordinance would only be limited to district property.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. So it's not quite as it's not as
No.
big of an umbrella as the public might. Yeah.
It's what we can do.
It's what we can do.
It's what we can do, and I, from my understanding and perspective, it's on activities that support and facilitate the expansion or the leasing of offshore oil. It's not saying we're not taking a stance against fossil fuels in general with this ordinance, I don't think. I think we're, the use of fossil fuels, but activities that would support and make it easier to lease areas offshore for offshore drill.
So again,
Right.
it's relating to the prohibition and storage and handling of oil related products, sorry, or prohibition of that on district owned lands. So we have some jurisdictional authority over the Port of Humboldt Bay, From a lands management standpoint, we're talking about what we manage, the terminal that the district owns, rather than terminal one and two specifically. This would be district-owned lands, but that would be the most likely site that something like this would occur.
And we already, passed a resolution here about the potential heavy lift marine terminal to make it as zero emission as possible, working towards being a zero emission facility.
There is a green terminal strategy, which is in play for the heavy lift marine terminal project. That is correct.
Okay.
All right. Going out to the public for any comments, questions on this item. All right. Quite. Oh, wait, sorry. Looks like Matt Simmons.
Hey, folks. Matt Simmons from the Environmental Protection Information Center, better known as EPIC. Just want to say that EPIC strongly supports this kind of ordinance. I think it should be expanded to natural gas as well as oil, because natural gas is the type of fossil fuel resource most likely to be excavated or extracted off our coast. And then Director Mickelson briefly mentioned offshore mining. While we haven't had quite as many conversations about it, offshore mining is another extractive use of our oceans that the Trump administration is pushing currently. And I think that the district should look at this as an opportunity to consider its position on the use of district-owned property for offshore mining activities off our coast as well. It's another very impactful industry for our oceans and for our ocean ecosystems. Looking forward to seeing the ordinance at a future meeting. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I can't see. It doesn't look like there's anyone else online raising their hand. No one in the public. Okay, bring them back. This is also just receiving a status update, so no vote. So moving on to new business. Consider adopting Resolution 2026-04. A resolution designating the Executive Director and Director of Administrative Services as authorized agents for the purpose of applying for and receiving funds from FEMA and the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. We have a staff report on this item.
Yeah, so I don't have the slide advanced here, but I think I can do this from memory. Thank you. So, Mike, thanks. Mindy, thank you. We have existing claims under a disaster declared DR 4683. This is from winter storms all the way back in 2022. We made application in 23. We have been in this process for quite some time. So at the time of filing applications and the time of knowing that we were eligible for assistance, although getting to assistance is quite challenging, there are certain criteria that has to be met, and there are certain designations that have to be met. So at that time, we authorized the executive director and the then deputy executive director as signatories and competent persons for this activity. It has been 3 years, so we have to update that to stay compliant with Cal OES and FEMA standards. So this resolution creates that the executive director and the now director of administrative services would be those signatories.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Do we have any discussion on this item? Yep. Anything from the public? All right, bringing it back for a vote then. There's an ordinance that we can just...
It's a resolution, yeah.
Is it a resolution?
We'll need a roll call vote.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, it is a resolution. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Yes, so can we have a roll call vote, please?
Absolutely. Commissioner Norton?
Aye.
Commissioner Benson?
Aye.
Commissioner Newman?
Aye.
And President Coleman?
Aye.
Thank you.
And then I will assume the minutes reflect that Commissioner Dale left the meeting at whatever time he did. Right. Consider adopting Resolution 2026-05, a resolution to authorize the execution of a grant agreement and accept funds from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife for the Secretariat Services for the Harbor Safety Committee of the Humboldt Bay Area for fiscal year 2026-2027. Seems like we do this every year.
We do.
Move.
Sure, I'll second.
So we have a motion and a second.
Benson Norton, is that correct?
Yes.
Was that you?
No, I think yeah, it was Newman Norton.
Thank you.
Second, very good.
And it's fishing game money. I want it.
This is for the operation of the Harbor Safety Committee.
That's correct. So this is our secretariat grant. This is the funding we received to host and have our Humboldt Harbor Safety Committee meetings, as well as the Humboldt Harbor Safety Plan. This is funded through the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Office of Oil Spill Prevention and Response. This is a big part of what we do. We're in a process right now of rewriting the Harbor Safety Plan. Well, it should be updated each year. There was a 2-year period where it was very challenging to get it done. We just couldn't get the volunteers. So this year is an update year with rewrite of some missing sections of some new sections that weren't previously contained in the Harbor Safety Plan. We also had the request from Aquaculture to become a voting seated member for the Harbor Safety Committee. That does have to be approved by the Office of Oil Spill and Response Administrator. And they aren't allowing a lot of additional seats. So we're working with some folks to write the narrative to justify why it's very important. We certainly believe the aquaculture should be have a seat at that on that committee. And so we're going to work to accomplish that. So it's going up each year. We got a little bit of an increase this year. I think we're at $23,649 this year. So we've been getting a small CPI increase each year. And so we do need a resolution, authorization for me to execute the grant agreement, as well as a resolution to accept it.
Great. Any additional discussion from the board?
I just want to say I was on this committee for a while, and it's a great place for the collaboration to occur between Fish and Wildlife, Coast Guard, Harbor District, local industry. It's just a great venue, actually.
Yeah, at each meeting, you know, to further what Aaron said, we have an update from each and one of the various committees. We talk about any activity that happened in the water, vessels, debris, spills, boats that are adrift, any safety issues such as that. We talk about navigational safety. So we have updates from U.S. Coast Guard MSD, the Marine Safety Detachment, California OSPR, the OSPR administrator and staff. We have each one of the local marinas, including Trinidad represent. We have people from the recreational community, both recreation such as aquatics and our Sport Fishing Association. In addition to that, the city of Eureka has not only their marina folks, but they have people from their, I believe it's Parks and Recs division, that come to the meeting. Our tugboat captains, our bar pilots, marine operators, of course, the Harbor District or the port itself. California Coastal Commission, as well as, let's see, no, I forgot one of them, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for Dredging and Navigation.
We have tribes, so have a seat. Or
yes, and so then we have, enhancing that, we have fisheries, and then we have tribal and environmental as a seat. So we looked at aquaculture to that.
It was, yeah, as my first interaction, I guess, with the Harbor District, sitting in the tribal environmental seat for a number of years. But yeah, great group, does great work. So important, protecting the resources in our day from oil spills and planning and prevention. So any comment, questions from the public? All right, looks like we got another resolution. So another roll call.
Mr. Benson?
Yes.
Mr. Norton?
Yes.
Mr. Newman?
Yes.
President Coleman.
I guess we're all saying yes this time. It's yeah, we have to change it up. Thing, yes. You know? Motion passes. All right. Final item, consideration of initial fiscal year 2026-2027 budget preparation schedule.
Absolutely. So there's nothing fancy for a staff report here. Staff is in a procedural mode, as you can see tonight. It's that time of year. But it is time for us to commence our budget schedule. So we would start next meeting with preliminary goals, stating our proposed income and expenditures for Woodley Island Marina, the Fields Landing Boatyard, and dredging activities. We'll follow that by the Marine Terminal, Shelter Cove, and then our general port operations, administration, staffing, et cetera. So that'll be the April meeting, the May meeting, the June meeting, and then we'll have our budget adoption in July. So we do have a budget advisory committee, that is Commissioner Norton and Commissioner Benson. We'd like to keep that committee intact. But we will be commencing these activities probably in the next couple of weeks. There's a lot of workload right now, but it takes a lot to get the budget out. I do want to recognize staff's efforts on it, not only by departments, but our director of administrative services does the heavy lifting in terms of all of the input and structuring of the budget, classing codes, and really digging out comparables over the prior year. So it's a big process. It's a big lift. And Rob asked for $1 million this morning, so
Yeah. Only money proved.
And so, are we approving an actual schedule, or just that we're
Just
the initial that we're going to start next time
Just
as
directing staff to implement.
Okay, so that
So
sounds.
staff is asking the commission to tell staff to go to work
It's
on
the
the budget.
procedure, sir.
Go to work and include us.
We'll be
It
there.
works.
Thank you. Thank you for being part of that subcommittee. Appreciate your work. Any comments, questions from the public on the initial fiscal year 2026 budget preparation schedule?
Was that a motion, Commissioner Benson?
Was that a motion?
Did we
The
have a
go to work
motion and
motion?
second? I guess
I
we
thought it was
did.
just a
No.
recommendation to go to work, but does it need to be
Okay.
formal?
Let's have a motion.
Okay.
Set us free.
Okay. I would like to make a motion that recommends that staff begin implementing the 2026-27 fiscal year budget preparation schedule.
I'll second that.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor, signify by saying aye or yes or whatever.
Aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Abstaining? Motion passes. With that, I think we are going to move to adjournment. I'm going to say if, with our crazy times now, if you have the opportunity to be kind to somebody, take it.
All right.
We're adjourned.
Nice. Thank you.